Welcome to the Penguin Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Penguin Podcast, where we're thinking about the planet that we call home, from its inhabitants to the perils of its great oceans. First up, popular literary heavyweight Will Self reads an extract from his latest book, Shark, where the crew aboard the USS Indianapolis find themselves treading water and facing what would be the biggest shark attack on humans in history.
Claude unties the tapes of his life vest, and the kid, some poor stupid hick like all the rest, raises his arms automatically, so they slide down and out of the armholes. You're welcome, and would sir like to try another sports coat? The hands are poised for a moment. Claude sees there's no skin or flesh on them at all, only cooked tendons stretched over white florets of knuckle bones. Then it's the last roll of the dice, my friend, and they're gone. Already 10 feet down, sinking fast, the kid's long-sleeved denim shirt twirls about him. His bell-bottom dungarees whir, and his pillbox hat oscillates, a white dot hopping from word to word across the sea's screen. Talk about the moon floating in the sky, looking at a lily on a lake. The kid is 20 feet down now, his arms up and circling, his feet down and revolving the other way. His hips swing as he hula-hulas into the deep. That doesn't seem so very deep due to the amazing clarity of the water. Claude experiments, turning his whole head because his eye sockets are filled with gritty sand. He sees the sea turn from green to aquamarine to cobalt blue to silvery to silver white, then vanish completely as I push my head up her skirt. Finest ear protector as a fellow can get. Flesh-filled nylons fitted snug to the head and dried with talc. The kid's maybe 40 feet down now, yet his dancing, plummeting body can still be clearly seen. Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk. At Wright-Patterson, combat veterans had told Claude that when their chutes collapsed, falling men spun. Even as the ship they'd bailed out of flipped up on its wing and spun away from them, while the Kraut fighter that had scored the hit wheeled away too. So everywhere in the sky could be seen spinning things. Talk about the moon. Claude supposes if the sinking kid could only tip his head back, he'd see my face floating in the sky. But really, it's too late for that. The kid must be nearing full fathom friggin' five. And the sun rays, which Claude sees flicker-fingering boots, tin cans, and other slowly descending debris, can no longer touch him. The kid has almost reached the Emerald City's limits. Claude wonders what sort of a how-d'ye-do he'll get from the welcoming committee that circles him. Their long, grey bodies zigging, zagging, and circling evasively. What are their names? Ah, yes. Ivan Shark, Fury Shark, Admiral Himakito, that chink shitbird Fang, and the sinister Barracuda. There's obviously no possibility of Claude warning the kid, let alone saving him, but for his own satisfaction at least, he wishes he'd had the patience to decipher that day's codograph, the useless mishmash of letters and numerals, that, as he watches the first inquisitive shark nuzzle the kid's belly, only spools through his own soggy head. AM859R45HJ88. At least, Claude thinks, I've taken my vitamins. And he feels for the morphine syrettes he took from the emergency packs in the rafts lashed to the bulkhead by the radio room. Reassuringly, they're still in the button-down pocket of his shirt. But how long can it be before the seawater happy talks its way up the hypos and ruins all those healthy vitae minds? All mine, this food. Those other lunkheads, the green hands running round like they were after coos, and the sad sack sailors trying to corral all those farm boys, prairie boys and banjo-picking freaks so as to herd him over the side. None of them had the smarts to pick up any supplies before they took the dive. Yes, Claude snickers to himself, they're all lesser men. Men who didn't volunteer for the secret squadron, which is why they mostly flipped their wigs when the torpedoes hit. Those who didn't flipped them when they saw their shipmates flying towards them across the tilting deck, the fleshy streamers flayed from their arms and legs, flapping in the hot air, blasting from the burning fuel. Flipped them at the grotesque sight, the skin angels in flight. Behind them, the flames flaring from the smokestack. Flipped them as the skin angels flocked to the fantail, where, too crazed by pain to recall the layout of their own ship, if they'd known it to begin with, they slithered about in its dying blood. Bilge water, piss and turds from the heads, melted ice cream, and still fizzing soda from the dumb gedunk stand, before launching themselves, screaming, over the taffrail. Claude had seen them when he was on board, their fledgling wings spread in the hellish light. He'd seen still more of them once he was struggling in the water as the mass of the sinking ship dragged him back. Although shocked by his searing slide down the hull and the cold impact of the waves, Claude realized either his abandonment of the ship had taken a fraction of the time it seemed, or there must be a great host of the skin angels. For there they'd been, high above him, each one silhouetted against the low scudding clouds for a couple of seconds, then launching into the air, managing maybe two or three futile wing beats before being swatted by the Indy's slowly revolving screws. "Quick, Henry, the flit!" and crumpling among all the other black flies into the sticky pool of fuel oil that lay molasses on the heaving waves. Waves that now cradle Claude so tenderly. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Raising him up, then easing him gently down. Best not, Claude thinks, get too far down, 'cause then I'll find myself with Royster Doister, little oyster, down in the slimy sea. You ain't so different, lying on your shell bed to the likes of little old me. Excepting that, Royster Doister, you're somewhat moister than I would like to. What the fuck did you do that for? The dumb Polack, whose name is Gorecki or something like that, pulls Claude's head from the water, tearing the sweetly salty sheets from his shell bed. Neptune's muffled subaquatic realm is conquered by this, the hurting disk of the noonday sun, the long, hard swell of the open ocean, and on the slope of that swell, the disintegrating chain of men Claude has deprived of a link by untying the kid's life vest and letting him sink.
Will Self, reading an extract from his book Shark, which is out now. But it's not just sharks that make the ocean a dangerous place. The power of the ocean tides and currents are not to be taken lightly, as Matt Lewis experienced firsthand aboard a deep-sea fishing boat in the Antarctic waters. He starts this interview with his editor, Ben Brusey, with a few lines from his book Last Man Off, where he describes the moment he and crew view the coastline of South Georgia after weeks at sea.
After weeks of looking at a seascape of shifting grey waves, South Georgia was a feast for our eyes. The island is 120 miles long, but narrow, with peaks almost 10,000 feet in height, seemingly rising straight from the water. The summits were shrouded by scarves of cloud and mist as we approached, but snow and ice highlighted valleys and gullies on their flanks in the low winter light. The coves and hills were green and brown with grass and soil, and spray bounced from the rocks along the shore. Glaciers had carved huge icebergs into the grey waters of the bay, and we watched in eagerness to see if one would actually fall before us. As though to remind us how far south we had come, sleet and snow blew across the boat, and we stuck our hands deep into our freezer suit pockets. Chugging slowly across Cumberland Bay towards the natural inner harbour of King Edward Cove, we kept our eyes open for the growlers and bergy bits, car-sized icebergs almost completely submerged but still capable of damaging the hull if hit at any speed. After anchoring a few hundred metres off the land, we saw the small cluster of historic single-storey buildings and the large new accommodation block that made up the settlement of King Edward Point. Elephant seals dotted the beaches, their grey-brown boulder forms indistinct at such a distance. Across the cove from King Edward Point, the rusty derelict buildings of Gritviken reminded us of the island's previous gold rush, not fish, but whales. The flensing pans where whales were hauled ashore and carved up, and the factory sheds where the blubber was processed were still visible through the binoculars. A few old wrecks lay rusting away in the shallows, their hunting days long gone. I was glad to see the rust.
That's fantastic. Thank you. I mean, was it sort of frightening? I mean, it sounds like sort of a wildlife documentary. It sounds like a David Attenborough programme. But was it nerve-wracking? Did you feel intimidated by nature at the same time?
When you get close to a glacier, they're intimidating because you're worried about what's going to happen next. But I think for the most part, even the weather was awe-inspiring. And only on the roughest days was it intimidating. And then the waves get so big that they do put fear of God into you.
And then as June arrived, did the weather start to change noticeably?
It was upon us before we knew it. It wasn't a gradual build-up from what I remember. The weather was so variable down there. Sometimes you'd get water that was so glassy calm. It was beautiful. It was hard to imagine we were in the Southern Ocean. And then just the next day, the waves would be up and the swell would gradually build up. And on the 6th of June, we woke up to see these monster waves coming through. The swells were enormous.
Yeah, and you should have stopped fishing that day, you think, but because you're behind, you kept going.
In retrospect, yes, we should have stopped fishing, but it wasn't my decision. And other crew members have said the same thing, that it wasn't the sort of thing that you could ask the skipper to do. You couldn't go up to the bridge and say, you know, I really think we should stop fishing now and we'll just have a cup of tea. That was not going to happen.
But all this while, water is pouring through.
Yeah, but all that while, also the water was pouring into the factory, but the pumps were getting rid of it overboard. So when I went down to the factory at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there were still pumps pumping water out of the factory. So water comes in, water goes out, that's okay. But then the pumps started to really get blocked by the fish waste. And before you knew it, the water was coming in, but it wasn't going out.
So gradually, I imagine, so slowly things were starting to get a bit chaotic. So things are sliding around.
Yeah, fish boxes were moving around, and the catch of the day as well was still building up, and the waste from that was joining in this soup around our feet.
Was there a moment where you thought the boat was going to sink?
Even until the last moment, I didn't think the boat was going to sink.
Did panic eventually spread out on deck? Were people panicking around?
To the credit of the crew, no. Nobody was panicking. There was nobody screaming or crying. There was no chaos. But while there was no chaos, sadly, there was also no direction from the officers, the guys who were in charge. Now, the skipper and the fishing master, the guys who had been on the bridge and had been telling us to carry on fishing, had gone quiet, and they weren't telling the crew what to do. When the crew looked for them for reassurance and for direction, you know, what are we going to do to save our lives? Then they weren't given any help. They just went quiet.
Were you afraid of having to go into the raft and go into the water? Was there a suit to wear? Were there emergency procedures to follow? I mean,
there were no emergency procedures. Yeah. I'm sure there were emergency procedures somewhere, but they weren't being put into action. And we had no survival suits to wear. I was lucky. I was one of just two people on board who had a deck suit, which was just a big, thick, waterproof suit. So I managed to grab that. Everybody else was in their oilskins, and a lot of the guys took their oilskins off because they knew they wouldn't be able to swim in them. So they took them off, and you're facing the Southern Ocean in a pair of jogging pants and a T-shirt. And then before I knew what was happening, we were launching life rafts. We launched four life rafts, but only three inflated. But that was enough to carry all of us. But then two of the deck bosses, jumped into a life raft and cut the rope and drifted away. And we'll never know, sadly, why they did it or how many of them were in the raft. We think there was just the two deck bosses, and maybe we saw them pull another person from the water, but we don't know how many people were actually in that raft. But in a life raft made for 14 or so, I think they drifted away, just a few of them, and then...
And they were never found?
They were never found, no.
But when you watch them leave, so these were two of the most responsible people, presumably on the boat.
Competent, and they came across as really knowing their stuff.
And they should have been getting you guys whipping you guys into shape.
I think they were worried that there would be a scramble for places and that the rafts would be swamped. Then, as we tried to abandon away from the boat, the big stern gantry, a big metal archway, came crushing down on top of us, and it just pushed our life raft underwater, scooped it, flooded it full of ice-cold water, and just the physical damage as well of having a big steel beam coming down on top of the raft. I think it probably damaged the raft, and it hit people on the head and damaged limbs, I think.
What was the captain doing at this point of the boat?
The captain or the skipper?
The skipper, sorry.
Well, Bubbles, the skipper, we think he had a heart attack and he'd collapsed on the deck. Now, it's a good question to ask because the captain, who was supposed to be in charge of the boat, was actually asleep in his bunk. But the fact is that day to day, Bjørgvin wasn't the captain of the boat, that he'd been brought on board, but spent an awful lot of his time in the cabin. And it was Bubbles and Butty that were running the boat day to day. And they hadn't even woken up Bjørgvin. So he woke up as the ship rolled over to one side, and Bubbles woke up screaming, "Come quick, Bjørgvin, the boat is sinking."
Nightmare scenario.
He walked out at just moments before we abandoned ship. And he found Bubbles collapsed on the deck. And together with me, we helped Bubbles to the back of the boat, to the stern, and then...
So he was collapsed. So
yeah,
you think he?
I think he'd just been overcome by the conditions, or whether he'd had a heart attack. But he was grey. His skin had gone grey, and he did not look well.
And you were the last man off the boat.
Yeah, I was the last man off. I didn't set out to be. It wasn't something I'd wanted to be. Yeah. But I was just so worried about leaving people on the boat, and we've been trying to help Bubbles, and so yeah, that's the way it worked out.
Matt Lewis talking about his frightening experience of escaping a sinking ship in the Antarctic Ocean. His book, Last Man Off, is out now. You're listening to the Penguin Podcast. Our next two authors have their feet firmly on the ground, Britain's ground, to be specific. We start with Claire Balding, whose new book, Walking Home, recounts her experiences of walking around the UK and how walking in the great outdoors has the power to connect the individual to Mother Nature in its rawest form.
Of all the things I work on, of all the programmes I have ever presented, Ramblings is my favourite. You might think half an hour on radio of two people, sometimes more, walking around the countryside is an odd concept for a series, but it works. At a rough estimate, I've covered about 1,500 miles of footpaths for Ramblings, or just for myself. I've tackled apocalyptic thunderstorms, struggled with blisters, a bad back, a twisted ankle, and the wrong clothes, and traipsed through the snow of the Perthshire Mountains with no voice. Me, not the mountains. They always speak. All these miles have changed my perception of the countryside, as well as revolutionising my knowledge of it. I realise that I spent my childhood looking at a skeleton of Britain, in which I knew obscure bones, but not about the spine of the Pennine Way, or anything about the capillaries of tiny footpaths that take us deep into the woods and along the riverbanks of our landscape. I have felt the delights of the northeast coastal path, the Highland Way from Milngai to Fort William, the Southwest Coast Path, and the South Downs Way. I have bounced on spring dews and crunched on autumn leaves. I have felt the brutal wind bend me like a misshapen hawthorn bush, and I've strolled for miles with the sun warming my cheeks and refracting off chalk and water. For Ramblings, my companions are always interestingly chosen. I've walked with historians, geologists, twitchers, botanists, poets, artists, and adventurers. They usually have boundless knowledge and endless enthusiasm, so I always learn something new. With every step, I discover more about the land in which we live. We usually cover at least 7 or 8 miles, but sometimes we venture further and are encased in our boots for most of the day. I love the stories that people reveal over those miles. I've told people all sorts of things during the course of a walk, and they have told me things they probably never thought they would open up about. That's because walking side by side is very different from sitting opposite someone. There's only occasional eye contact, so none of that awkward looking up and away if you think you've caught their eye for too long. You are sharing an experience, looking at a view together, puffing up a hill, or watching the waves crash into the rocks below. You face the weather together, and as 2 or 3 hours unfold, the layers peel back, It is therapy for the soul. It's as if walking has unlocked a part of my brain, the way that riding did when I was a child. And walking with other people gives me a chance to satisfy my inquisitive mind. I can ask all the questions I want to ask, and they, for the most part, seem fairly willing to answer them. I also try to walk alone as much as possible, or just with Alice. Except we're not quite on our own. We're with Archie, our Tibetan terrier. The other day in a London park, I suddenly noticed a tree I'd never seen before. It looked like a twisted rope leading up to a shaggy head of hair. I stopped and stared, lost in the moment. Archie sniffed the tree and cocked his leg. He does have a way of bursting your bubble. Walking slows me down. It gives me time to think, time to explore the land, the seasons, the person and the dog I share my life with, and the beauty in every day. There is a frequency your brain tunes into after about 2 hours as the rhythm of your footfall becomes its only beat. It is like meditation, a means of earthing your body and your mind. This is the story of the paths I have walked, the people I have met, how my understanding of our country has changed, and how walking has shaped my life. I love it, and I need it. Now I make sure that I start every day with an hour-long walk with Archie, and I always look forward to the evening when I get the chance to walk him again. And whether or not we're recording for radio, I never need an excuse to get out there and discover a new path.
An extract from Walking Home, written and read by Claire Balding, which is available now. Robert McFarlane is the second author to connect with the land by following the ancient tracks that form part of a vast network of routes across Britain and the continents beyond. We have here a reading from his book The Old Ways, which is about people and place, about walking as a reconnaissance inwards, and the subtle ways in which we are shaped by the landscapes through which we move. Humans are animals, and like all animals, we leave tracks as we walk. Signs of passage made in snow, sand, mud, grass, dew, earth or moss. The language of hunting has a luminous word for such mark-making. Foil. A creature's foil is its track. We easily forget that we are track makers, though, because most of our journeys now occur on asphalt and concrete, and these are substances not easily impressed. Always, everywhere, people have walked, veining the earth with paths visible and invisible, symmetrical or meandering, writes Thomas Clarke in his enduring prose poem In Praise of Walking. It's true that once you begin to notice them, you see that the landscape is still webbed with paths and footways, shadowing the modern-day road network or meeting it at a slant or perpendicular. Pilgrim paths, green roads, drove roads, corpse roads, trods, lays, dykes, drongs, sarns, snickets. Say the names of paths out loud and at speed, and they become a poem or rite. Holloways, bossels, chutes, driftways, lichways, ridings, halterpaths, cartways, carnies, causeways, here paths. Many regions still have their old ways, connecting place to place, leading over passes or round mountains to church or chapel, river or sea. Not all of their histories are happy. In Ireland, there are hundreds of miles of famine roads, built by the starving during the 1840s to connect nothing with nothing in return for little, unregistered on Ordnance Survey base maps. In the Netherlands, there are Doodwegen and Spookwegen, death roads and ghost roads, which converge on medieval cemeteries. Spain has not only a vast and operational network of cañada, or drove roads, but also thousands of miles of the Camino de Santiago, the pilgrim routes that lead to the shrine of Santiago de Compostela. For pilgrims walking the Camino, every footfall is doubled, landing at once on the actual road and also on the path of faith. In Scotland, there are clachan and raad, cairned paths and sheeling paths, and in Japan the slender farm tracks that the poet Basho followed in 1689 when writing his Narrow Road to the Far North. The American prairies were traversed in the 19th century by broad bison roads, made by herds of buffalo moving several beasts abreast, and then used by early settlers as they pushed westwards across the Great Plains. Paths of long usage exist on water as well as on land. The oceans are seamed with seaways, routes whose course is determined by prevailing winds and currents, and rivers are among the oldest ways of all. During the winter months, the only route in and out of the remote valley of Zanskar in the Indian Himalayas is along the ice path formed by a frozen river. The river passes down through steep-sided valleys of shaly rock on whose slopes snow leopards hunt. In its deeper pools, the ice is blue and lucid. The journey down the river is called the Chadar, and parties undertaking the Chadar are led by experienced walkers known as ice pilots, who can tell where the dangers lie. Different paths have different characteristics depending on geology and purpose. Certain coffin paths in Cumbria have flat resting stones on the uphill side on which the bearers could place their load, shake out tired arms and roll stiff shoulders. Certain coffin paths in the west of Ireland have recessed resting stones, in the alcoves of which each mourner would place a pebble. The prehistoric trackways of the English Downs can still be traced, because on their close, chalky soil, hard packed by centuries of trampling, daisies flourish. Thousands of work paths crease the moorland of the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, so that when seen from the air, the moor has the appearance of chamois leather. I think also of the zigzag flexure of mountain paths in the Scottish Highlands, the flagged and bridged packhorse routes of Yorkshire and mid-Wales, and the sunken green sand paths of Hampshire, on whose shady banks ferns emerge in spring, curled like croziers. The waymarking of old paths is an esoteric lore of its own, involving cairns, grey weathers, sarsens, hoarstones, longstones, milestones, cromlechs and other guide signs. On boggy areas of Dartmoor, fragments of white china clay were placed to show safe paths at twilight, like Hansel and Gretel's pebble trail. In mountain country, boulders often indicate fording points over rivers. Utsi's stone in the Cairngorms, for instance, which marks where the Alt Moor burn can be crossed to reach traditional grazing grounds, and onto which has been deftly incised the petroglyph of a reindeer that, when evening sunlight plays over the rock, seems to leap to life. Paths and their markers have long worked on me like lures, drawing my sight up and on and over. The eye is enticed by a path, and the mind's eye also. The imagination cannot help but pursue a line in the land, onwards in space, but also backwards in time to the histories of a route and its previous followers. As I walk paths, I often wonder about their origins, the impulses that have led to their creation, the records they yield of customary journeys, and the secrets they keep of adventures, meetings and departures. The Old Ways by Robert McFarlane, out now in book and audiobook. The Earth is a resilient planet. It has existed for millions of years, supporting and nurturing different life forms. But the planet has its limits, and as we face a climate crisis, the need to plan for the future is more crucial than ever. Naomi Klein recently spoke at an event to present her latest book, This Changes Everything, which tackles the most profound threat humanity has ever faced. The war our economic model is waging against life on Earth. Here's a recording from the event, courtesy of The Guardian.
I called the book This Changes Everything, which admittedly is a bit of a brash title, because I think it's important to start the conversation about climate change in the right place. And that place in 2014 is that we have procrastinated for so long. We have allowed our emissions to increase by so much year after year that there are no non-radical options left on the table. So what that means is that we are being told by the vast majority of climate scientists and also by some of our most establishment institutions like the World Bank, the International Energy Agency, PricewaterhouseCoopers, that if we continue on the road we're on, if we engage in what they call business as usual, we are headed towards 4 to 6 degrees of warming above pre-industrial levels. That changes everything about our physical world. That leaves us with a world that is unrecognizable. And all we have to do to arrive at that place is nothing. We just have to keep doing what we do, which is allow those emissions to increase every year and to stay on this path of unrestrained growth. And of course, business as usual is a bit of a misnomer because the easy to get fossil fuels are largely depleted. So we are doubling down on the dirtiest fossil fuels, on oil from places like the Alberta tar sands, from my country, I'm not proud to say, natural gas from fracking, which has higher methane emissions. So it isn't just doing the same thing. In order to stay on this road, we have to take ever greater risks, both locally and globally. So the good news is that it is not too late to prevent those catastrophic outcomes. We can still keep warming below 2 degrees, which is what our governments agreed to when they went to Copenhagen in 2009. We could even keep warming lower than that, which I think would be very wise, but we cannot do this without radical changes to our political and economic system. Now, this was not always so. If we acted when we first found out about this problem, there were more gradual responses on the table available to us. But there is what the American climate scientist Michael Mann at Penn State University calls a procrastination penalty. Which means that if you delay and delay and keep barreling down that road, you then need to cut your emissions so deeply that they start to challenge the fundamental logic of our economic system, and the solutions become ideologically heretical in our times. In the book, I spend a fair bit of time talking about, trying to answer this question of why we have failed so spectacularly. And there's been a lot written on this question, and there have been a lot of theories floated. A lot of the time we hear it's just human nature, we're too selfish, we're too greedy, it's too far off, it's too hard for governments to come together and come to an agreement. And there's a little bit of truth in all of these rationales. It is hard, but then again, our governments have come together and built the World Trade Organization, which is an extremely complex system with global governance and a system of penalties. And the idea that this is too far off, I think is being shattered every year as we see more and more immediate impacts of climate change. Right now, California is in the midst of a 3-year drought that is impacting agriculture, some of the most important agriculture lands in the United States. So this idea that this isn't happening yet, that we're waiting for some sort of a crisis before we respond, I also don't think really holds water. The reason I believe that best explains this collective failure is just simply historical bad timing, which is that this crisis landed on our laps at the worst possible moment in recent history, which is, to be precise, 1988. This is when we lost all plausible deniability. This is when governments first came together to negotiate a path towards emission reductions. 1988 was the year the IPCC was formed that eventually led to the Climate Convention at the Rio Earth Summit. So what else was happening in 1988? Their first free trade deal was signed between Canada and the U.S. that eventually turned into NAFTA, that became the prototype for so many other so-called free trade deals. The Berlin Wall fell the next year. As Owen was just describing, this was the triumphant moment for the neoliberal project, for what Joseph Stiglitz calls market fundamentalism, the idea that there is no alternative, that history is over, that it is the role of government just to get out of the way of business to facilitate the most rapid accumulation of profit that would then trickle down and benefit the rest of us. We have been living, this is our history, but we haven't spent enough time talking about how that ideology, how that mindset clashes directly with the most obvious things that we need to do to rise to this challenge. This is the ultimate collective crisis that requires unprecedented collective action, and it landed on our laps at the very moment that we were told there was no such thing as society and that there was something sinister about the very idea of the public. So, you know, I'm just going to run down very quickly the way in which these two projects, one responding to climate change, the other liberating markets of all constraint, clash fundamentally. The most obvious is just what we need our public sphere to be. If we are going to lower our emissions in time, we need to invest massively in the public sphere. That means public transit that is affordable to everyone, preferably free. That means transforming our agricultural system. That also means, you know, the obvious transition to renewable energy. But also, because we've delayed so long, we have to prepare ourselves for the heavy weather that we've already locked in. And that also takes big public investment.
Naomi Klein, speaking at a Guardian Live event about her latest book, This Changes Everything, which is out now. And that's it from the Penguin Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes for future podcast episodes and head to SoundCloud for other author readings and audiobook extracts. You can find that at www.soundcloud.com/penguin-books. To find out more about the authors and books featured in this episode, visit the website thepenguinpodcast.co.uk. And if you have any comments, find us on Twitter at Penguin Audio using the hashtag Penguin Podcast.
You've been listening to the Penguin Podcast.